Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, everyone. I think we're going to get started. My name is Sarah Fullerton. I'm the communications director for UC Berkeley's Arts and Design Initiative. And I'm here on behalf of our associate vice chancellor, Shannon Jackson. We are the proud sponsors today for this session. I know I speak for Shannon when I say that it's been an absolute pleasure for us to organize this session titled Direct Action, Protest, and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. After the groundbreaking book by today's speaker, L.A. Kaufman, who will be in conversation with Rebecca Solnit. Both Kaufman and Solnit need little introduction. Both are legends in the realms of activism and organizing. For more than 30 years, L.A. Kaufman has been immersed in political organizing and radical movements as a journalist, historian, and strategist. Her writings on grassroots activism and social movement history have been published in The Nation, The Progressive, Mother Jones, Village Voice, and numerous others. With L.A. is my personal hero, Rebecca Solnit, whose work has long been a source of inspiration for myself and many, many others. Rebecca's commitment to social, racial, environmental justice, reproductive rights, and so forth has produced a prolific body of writing. Turning my page, sorry. That has been a guiding force. Rebecca's list of publications is simply too long to summarize here, but I'll mention a few of my favorites, including the 2015 Men Explain Things to Me, A Field Guide for Getting Lost, Hope in the Dark, and her most recent book, Drown River, The Death and Rebirth of Glen Canyon on the Colorado. Without further ado, please help me in welcoming L.A. Kaufman and Rebecca Solnit to the stage.
The title of our event makes it sound like I'm here to interview you, so... How is it being back in the Bay Area? Do you recognize us?
Well, I only got here yesterday, but when I've been visiting recently, it has certainly changed pretty dramatically since when I lived here.
You know, and it's also interesting thinking that the book that you did, you began a long time ago, and it must have been interesting having such a moving target of kind of, you know, direct action, because so much has happened in the last, really even in the last, I don't know, but we could start from Occupy Wall Street, the last 7 years, let's say. And how do you think about this kind of mutating, multiplying, braiding, fraying sort of strains of activism that make up, you know, kind of radical culture in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, first of all, I just want to say thank you to the festival. I'm really delighted to be here today. Thank you so much to all the organizers for having us, and it's a thrill to be here with Rebecca. The direct action took me 25 years to write. I wasn't working on it the whole time. So anybody who has a manuscript you're working on and you feel like it's taking a long time, please take heart, because we are not all as prolific as Rebecca. But part of why it took me so long was that it was a really hard story to put together, to make sense of what's happened to the American left and to our landscape of activism and resistance since the 60s. Because what's happened has been proliferation. We have a huge array of movements and a really complex landscape that's multiple, diverse, decentralized. And that character, that long shift that took place over the period from the early 70s until when I finished the book ends with Black Lives Matter, that's kind of the landscape that we had at the moment that I'm sure we'll be returning to over and over again, the moment when the new president took office and this new resistance emerged. So the sense that I have, there's still kind of voices that are holding on to this idea of a single left and a single kind of integrated, unitary opposition, which is such a strange kind of blindness when we have this incredible richness, as you've written about in many contexts.
And both richness and conflict. And there are many lefts, and they don't all have the same vision of who should be in charge and where we should be headed, and a few other key things like that, of course. something you and I have talked about a lot in private.
Indeed, but you know, people. I mean, the way that organizing work is, people vote with their feet, right? And so people have gravitated to other forms, to particularly these women-led, decentralized, networked, small group forms, which people have been experimenting with in many contexts since the advent of the Women's Liberation Movement in the early 70s, but is also what really characterizes the resistance to Trump right now. I mean, this is we're here in Berkeley, where it may be hard to have perspective. This is a place where protest happens a lot and has happened a lot, but it's quite striking. I've been looking really closely at the numbers. We have really great data on protests under Trump, and there are more people. There have been more people protesting in the last 15 months than at any time in American history. And I say people, but if you'll give me just 1 second, I want to say it's...
Which people?
Yes. Which people would those be?
That's the biggest question for the work you've been doing lately, is distinguishing which people.
Well, it's very striking. I mean, when you look at the big marches, I mean, it's women. Basically, it's women. In every context you look, it has been majority women. The big marches, men are showing up in pretty good numbers. The big marches, the data is like 54-56% women in the era of Trump. But when you look at really who's doing the work, when you look at anything from who's making phone calls to Congress, that's 86% women, to when you look at who are the organizers of the thousands of grassroots groups that have sprung up around the country, most of those, there's exceptions, but most of them, when you look, it's about 80% women. In context after context, there's this, you know, enormous outpouring, and it's women-led.
Does it feel like the genders are sort of splitting off in some way? Because we see, you know, because the parallel to what you're doing is Michael Kimmel's new book, whose title I forget, but somebody is about to shout out, and then I'll thank them, about the fact that the alt-right, from ISIS to Nazis, is almost all men. And he's somebody who's written about gender and violence and sort of the things that go on in the psyches of violent young men for a long time. And he talks about how, of course, if like all of our alt-right, marches, all of our mass shooters, all of our, you know, all the members of ISIS were women, that would be considered, people would notice, and then they'd probably decide that all women should be locked up forever, which, of course, a lot of them already have decided. But it's almost all men. There's something about this right, which I think is because so much of what they're selling is a regressive vision of a return to white, heteronormative, patriarchal authoritarianism. And it does feel sometimes, and it's obviously not all men are in the alt-right, not all women are in women's marches, but it does feel to me like there's a way the genders are peeling off, and the fact that young women know that marriage is not going to have a lot to do with their financial well-being necessarily. They're not dependent, even imaginatively, or you know, on men the way that they used to be. It's a really interesting thing where gender itself almost seems like not quite political policy, but maybe or groups, but maybe tendencies.
Yeah, I mean, there's a. I feel like there's a palpable character of gender war to what's happening now. And to say that, you don't want to oversimplify. We all know that a majority of white women voted for Donald Trump, for instance. Women are not a monolithic category, and neither are men. But there's the combination of, you know, exactly the phenomena you're talking about, the extent of masculinist backlash in the new alt-right and in and around this very menacing administration, counterposed to this women-led resistance, which we also sort of aren't naming. It's I'm always saying this, emphasizing that it's mostly women, because there's a way in which it's happening all around us and we're not talking about it in demographic terms at all. It's like it's too scary to really look at the extent of division there is right now between a well-organized, persistent, determined, woman-led progressive movement and a very well-organized, persistent, determined, violent, masculinist backlash.
Yeah, it feels like some of the loneliness of the incels and a lot of these men on the right is that they've gone to a place in their psyches and their online lives, et cetera, that women have no interest in being part of, and partly because it's often seething with hatred for women. But it is this weird kind of self-segregation, and that's, you know, contains the paradox that they hate women, and then they're mad that women don't want to hang out with them, and those two factors aren't correlated. What, you know, like come over here and make me feel good, I hate you, you should die, is not an unusual message for young women to hear, but when it's that clear, it's sometimes not that seductive. You know, and it's interesting thinking of, in a way, if this is backlash, it's a sign of how effective feminism as a transformation of women's lives and power is right now. Do you think of it in those terms at all?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think if we didn't...
I mean, yeah. Know,
I mean...
or as my niece used to say, yaw.
I mean, it's a reaction to our power, but that doesn't make it any less menacing and unsettling.
Yeah.
I mean, we obviously, the attack in Toronto is fresh in everyone's mind. An organizer I work closely with and greatly admire was out leading a training with the Alaska Grassroots Alliance last weekend, and a random white supremacist guy broke into their training and sprayed them all with bear mace, and it turned out when they finally apprehended him, he had committed a racially motivated murder years before. And, you know, they're lucky he didn't come in with an AR-15. There's mm-hmm. this sense now of, you know, we know there's this long history of this kind of lone wolf male violence, but in the context of this organized resistance, there's a way in which the menace is quite real and quite unsettling.
Yeah. I often feel that they can win individual battles, but, you know, they can't win the war because it's never going to be 1954, whenever their fantasy of when America was great again, you know, was.
Indeed.
Yeah. And, you know, but there are going to be a lot of battles. And, so you're heartened by this, you know, sort of feminist power and by the level of engagement. And what else do you see going on that maybe isn't being seen that well and detected? And
Well, what's really interesting to me is, so in terms of the resistance to Trump, there's... is not just the scale of it. The numbers are, as I said, enormously high. 10 to 15 million people have attended protests over the last year. But what's more striking to me, you know, that is larger in absolute numbers, but where the growth is really remarkable is the number of places where people are taking action. So there were women's marches. Yes, there was a huge one in D.C., but they happened in 650 other communities around the country. And when the March for Our Lives happened last month in March, those happened in more than 700 communities around the country. There are now more than 900 communities around the country that are signed up to do emergency rapid response actions if Robert Mueller should be fired. So we're seeing this really, and just for as a benchmark from comparison, back in the day, going from the 69 moratorium to the 2003 anti-war protests, it always kind of held steady at about 200 cities. There have been these, you know, coordinated protests around the country, but we're seeing many, many more places where people are getting engaged. We're seeing that people are not just marching and protesting, but they're carrying forward with... There's now something like 6,000 groups that are affiliated with Indivisible, some of which, yeah, which is just a stunning number. There are other examples where there's like 1,000 groups that come out of a movement. To me, it's really the ubiquity of what's happening now that is the most striking. It's in red states, it's in blue states, it's in rural areas, it's in urban areas. There are people, women in motion, mostly women in motion, at this very grassroots level all over the place.
Are you recording this? Okay. They're recording it, and it does look like you've been pointing your camera at me for a long time. What was I going to ask?
I don't know.
Like, was it about the surveillance society? He's at it again.
He is at it again.
Yeah. Oh, good. He's being reprimanded. So it gets a little weird. So, and I guess, and another perception I have that feels kind of heartening is that I've been around movements since the early 80s, thanks to my brother David, who's one of the heroes of your book, who we're very proud of, since I have a brother and nephews in the front row. And but I've seen so many things where it's like, we'll stop this war, we'll stop this logging, we'll stop this nuclear testing, we'll stop this bad law, and then we'll like wash our hands and go home and be apolitical. And what I like about what I'm seeing now, but I wonder how you perceive it, is that I don't see a lot of people with a sense of like, and obviously it's stop Trump, but what does that mean, you know? And I like it when people realize that Trump is just sort of a symptom of the far right and not a lone phenomenon. But it does feel like people kind of understand that this is, you know, this is long term and this is a sort of deep engagement. And
yeah, I think so. I mean, part of what was interesting about the original set of women's marches, they weren't cast as a pressure tactic. It wasn't a gathering. Nobody thought it was going to change Trump's mind about anything or change his policies. It was a gathering of our forces, right? It was a rallying of our side. And, you know, in a sense, it was like the kickoff. And there was an understanding of that it wasn't march and you've done your part and you go home and you know, have a souvenir from the day and then feel like you're politically engaged. I think people, you know, that is always a fairly shallow form of participation and maybe not that common. But in this case, I think people really took to heart the sense that we have to dig in for the long haul, that we have to be operating on many levels. It's about resisting the damage now and then laying the groundwork for some kind of repair in the longer term. You know, people have been very open to being multi-tactical in a way that's really refreshing. And in particular, there have been many times on the left when there was like a huge divide between people doing electoral work and people doing movement work, and that's just disappeared. And it's disappeared in a particular way that I think is very interesting, because we all, maybe we don't all know, but the Democratic Party is not going to be the vehicle that's going to save us in this moment. And the way that this organizing is unfolding has been really on the perimeter of the party. You know, it's playing out differently in different localities, with a lot of friction, a lot of quiet friction you know, I hope somebody is doing a book on. I hope somebody's following how this is playing out. But you have this kind of massive, decentralized, women-led grassroots force all around the country where people are doing door-to-door canvassing, they're doing voter registration, they're doing kind of all the base-building stuff that the Democratic Party has avoided for so long, and they're not letting themselves just get absorbed into the party. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, and what's exciting for me about that is that there's often been this sense of like, oh, the Democratic Party is flawed, and if you join it, you share their flaws, if you deal with it anyway. So we'll be pure and ineffectual on the margins, and we'll wave to you from over here where our awesomeness is. And it just feels like there's a kind of pragmatism that, yeah, you can go like put pressure on the Democratic Party, get out the vote, etc. And that does, and it's also interesting to me because there are so many Democratic parties, and the Democratic Party of this local candidate is not the Democratic Party of the DNC in Washington, and that, you know, and it feels like there's a different level of sophistication at work, which is great, because those simple binaries and obsessions with purity that are often kind of one-dimensional storytelling feel like a lot of what's afflicted the left in its ability to function and build coalitions, like people who aren't exactly like them, and things like that.
And this pragmatism might have something to do with the fact that the movement is women-led.
And people of color, too, who are, you know, because there is this kind of like, oh, we're too pure to do that, and then there are people who are like, we're kind of tired of dying, so we might try that.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah. the stakes are high, so why not win incremental victories while asking for more fundamental transformative change as opposed to just holding on to your pure outsider position? I see very little of that right now.
Do you think it's partly that except for certain white guys, people have gotten over the fantasy of sudden total revolution, which was such an abiding fantasy that, you know, from the Russian Revolution to the Cuban Revolution, that you would have regime change, and then that would change everything, and then you could go home. And I think I get the impression people don't really believe in that, and they recognize that there's so much change that comes from below, and that so much of it is cultural. Like, you know, one of the examples I always use is it's not about, like, the Supreme Court hands down marriage equality, and that's who gave it to us. It's that millions of non-straight people came out of the closet to their friends, their family, their coworkers, their community, and built a completely different consciousness about the ubiquity and ordinariness of not being heterosexual, and that made other changes inevitable. But is it partly getting over the fantasy of sudden dramatic? And certainly in the U.S., like that kind of toppling the regime stuff that was a big part of the 60s.
Yeah, and which is pretty much absent. I mean, that's a powerful theme of the other book that's sitting on your lap, Hope in the Dark, which I reread yesterday, and which was wonderful to do. And
bite-sized.
And you talk about how important the Zapatista Revolution was in as a beacon of this different vision of what an insurrectionary movement could look like, as opposed to the old drama of, you know, replacing one flawed regime with a new one, hardening the categories, creating new forms of oppression. This vision of a fluid, dynamic, permanent opposition, and that is what generates the most productive change over time. In your book, you explore very powerfully how that kind of change, it's not the sudden, like, you know, storming the Winter Palace, right?
Yeah.
It's slower. It's sometimes you can't see the effects in the immediate moment, but it's profound, as with the marriage equality example that you cited.
You know, and that reminds me of one of my favorite stories in the book, which I used to write about this amazing volume, No Home is Complete Without, last year, which is how the, I was going to say plowshares, but I mean not Abalone Alliance, Clamshell Alliance. There's this amazing anti-nuclear movement in the 1970s, a Clamshell Alliance, that sets out with a specific goal, which is to prevent, is it the Seabrook nuclear power plant from opening? Do we have any clamshell members here? Or? Oh my God, yay! Okay, any Abalone Alliance people? Yay, thank you. You're amazing. So they had one very specific goal, which was to stop this nuclear power plant, which they didn't do. And now let's tell the story of what, and there's a way, if you tell history, of like they set out to do X and they didn't do X. You know, when you do it like, you know, first grade math, well, you know, you didn't, 1 + 1 didn't get all the way to 2. But there's this whole other way of telling it that's so present in the book and so exciting. And I wonder if you would tell some of it, and then I'll probably barge in because I find it so exciting.
Right. Well, they didn't stop the Seabrook plant, although it was a very, very, very long time before it opened. But no other nuclear power plant opened after that in the United States
ever.
You know, sometimes you have to lose on the way to winning. We had that very much in the community garden fight that I was involved in New York City, where we did ultimately end up saving a huge number of community gardens, but only after we lost some. And, you know, you have to have the vision to organize past the defeats and see the defeats, in fact, as fuel for a longer-term victory.
Amen. But then also what was exciting for me about the clamshell is that the long, long lineage of Quaker activism brought the consensus process, which almost every organizing group has used ever since, a kind of non-hierarchical, inclusive way of making decisions that's not majority rule, but full inclusion, and non-violent direct action. Feminism had a huge impact. So they developed this completely new toolkit, and everything I've ever done as an activist comes out of that transformation, which was also part of the feminism that doesn't get remembered, that that was against the charismatic leaders of the radical 60s that led to cults and a lot of other kind of violent and miserable dead ends. And it feels almost sometimes to me that human nature itself changed, that there was a kind of entrenched deference to authority that led to, you know, Jonestown and the Rajneeshis and things, the willingness to be followers that isn't so present. But also feminism was kind of anti-leader and more anarchic and about dispersed power and inclusiveness, and that became something that's now ordinary to movements that we saw at Occupy Wall Street. We see we've seen in the anti-nuclear organizing I was part of in the 80s and 90s, and it's one of those things that fascinates me, where the change is so successful that it becomes the ordinary background and people don't remember that it didn't used to be like that.
Absolutely. And that the advent of that new model is completely shaping, you know, what's happening now in terms of the resistance to Trump. What's interesting to me, what's missing in this 15 months and, you know, nearly 15 million people protesting in the streets is actually direct action. There's been really very, very little direct action since Trump took office. We have this amazing data, this very, very detailed data about protests, and you can go through, if you're obsessive like I am, you could go through and really look very closely at who's undertaking direct action under Trump and who's not. The numbers are minuscule. They're out of some 13,000 individual protests that have happened in 15 months of Trump. There have been about 175 direct action-oriented protests. And only not even quite 3,000 arrests, which, you know, some of the big anti-nuclear actions came close to that for a single action. So it's this interesting moment where we have this incredible breadth of organizing, and people have been multi-tactical towards the electoral side, you know, being really willing to embrace everything from street protest and direct support to vulnerable communities, you know, that form of direct action. But in terms of nonviolent civil disobedience, there's been almost none. And who's been doing it have been, you know, you could say it's because people are frightened under Trump and are vulnerable, but the folks who have been putting their bodies on the line in that way in this era have all been the very most vulnerable. It's been Black Lives Matter, it's been the Dreamers, it's been Native-led protests against pipelines, and it's been people with disabilities and other medically fragile folks fighting for health care. And that's it.
And some stuff about the big pharma. I wonder if you talk about if you want to talk about the pharmaceutical stuff you've been connected to.
Yeah, I've been over the last couple of months. I've been working very closely with the photographer Nan Golden and her group Pain, which has been taking on the pharmaceutical profiteers who are at the root of the opioid crisis in the United States. Nan Golden she had had a heroin problem in the 70s, and a few years back she was prescribed OxyContin by her doctor for a wrist injury, and became immediately addicted, as many, many people have. Was addicted for many years. She's now been in recovery for about a year, and she went public with her addiction and her struggle, I think just in December or January, and decided to hold the Sackler family accountable, the family that not only manufactured and pushed OxyContin and did so knowing the risks of it, but had also pioneered the whole marketing model that's at the root of pharmaceutical profiteering with Valium and with pushing Valium to any and all comers, mostly women as well. So that is some direct action. We have not had any arrests yet, but we've done two now direct actions at museums with wings named after the Sackler family. We did an action in March at the Temple of Dendur at the Metropolitan Museum, where we threw 1,000 fake OxyContin bottles into the fountain and held a die-in. And so after Arthur Sackler's widow complained that he was being unfairly tarred, he's the guy who made the marketing model for Valium, we just went down on Thursday to the Arthur Sackler Gallery in Washington, D.C., where we threw OxyContin and Valium bottles into the fountain.
That sounds fair and balanced. Oh, my God, where do we go from here? And that could apply to this conversation or the whole country.
I'm curious to hear what things are making you most hopeful right now. What things in the landscape you're really fixing on as signs of hope?
Two things that always come up for me. One is that half the people under 18 in this country are not white, and you see how awesome like the Parkland students are, and that this rising generation kind of gets the connections between economics and race and gender. They're not nearly as homophobic as anyone who ever came before them. And a lot of them are actually think very fluidly about their own gender and who they're attracted to. So that's coupled with the fact, and this is something I've written about because it doesn't feel widely enough understood, the Republicans could not have won any of the last many national elections except through massive voter suppression. And that's something that's been so neglected, and people are now really on dealing with the gerrymandering, dealing with the different kinds of voter suppression from people with felony convictions. I think we have a bill for people who are even in prison in California to be allowed to vote. Dealing with, you know, the cross-check program, et cetera. And so, like, you look at how Donald Trump won, and it took a perfect storm of misogyny and a sort of challenged candidate, another party, but also it took foreign intervention, massive voter suppression. And to the best of my ability to count up all the different things, about 20 million people were unable to vote in the last election. And, like, let's say only half of them were going to vote. You know, that there were a 50% turnout. That doesn't mean that, you know, almost none of them were going to vote Republican, which is why they weren't allowed to vote. And a lot of times when I talk like this, people are like, oh, you're saying Hillary would have won. And it's so much more interesting and more radical than that. If we had not massively disenfranchised, there's always been disenfranchisement. Only white men were allowed to vote. First with property, then without property. Black men officially got the vote in 1870, but as we all know through the South, you know, have rarely had full and equal voting opportunity. Women got the vote 98 years ago. But if we had full, free, and fair elections, it wouldn't be Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. The Republican Party would have died, and the Democratic Party might be something completely different. The candidates would be completely different if poor people, people of color, young people were fully enfranchised. And we would have had a completely different race. And I feel like we might be, and I don't think electoral politics will save us, but they could not damn us, which would be super nice. And so, you know, so I see that enormous shift coming. And also, like, I've been writing about violence against women since, like, a cover story in Maximum Rock and Roll in 1985. And there was this long, like, all my life until about 2012, it felt like we couldn't get anyone to talk about the problem on us, you know, as an epidemic, as a crisis, as a human rights violation, as something completely intolerable. And again, a lot of it is about young feminists who spoke up about campus rape and showed up elsewhere and are just kind of unabashed and uncompromising about you know, the fact that they're human beings endowed with certain inalienable rights. And the feminist movement the last 5 years has just been extraordinary in remaking what this world is going to be and who's going to make it and who it's for. And seeing Bill Cosby be found guilty this week was really amazing. And it's kind of pathetic saying, like, a guy who assaulted more than 60 women and got over it for half a century, you know. But it does feel like something shifted. And what I know about cultural transformation is the genie never quite gets back in the bottle. And I think that, you know, you can't convince people that homosexuals are coming for your children, you know, once everybody's used to the fact that it's like Joe, your supervisor, and Jeff, your brother-in-law, and, you know, and Sally, your best friend from kindergarten and stuff. And, you know, I think with feminism, too, that they can take away reproductive rights, but they can't take away women's belief that we have the right to self-determination over our bodies. And it is, you know, but this feminist shift in so many ways is something I've been waiting for my whole life, and it's addressing the horrific and destructive epidemic of violence against women at last. And what's amazing to me is seeing so many women who have been pretty successful. Diana Nyad, who did that amazing swim from Cuba to Florida, but had been raped for years by her coach. And you just think of, you know, you think of the toll that racism takes, the toll that misogyny takes, the toll that poverty takes, and you see people do extraordinary things despite this. And it's, you know, and you think, like, these people were heroes despite everything. What would they be capable of if we removed a few of the things designed to destroy them? And then one last thing that's kind of amazing, and then I feel like I never expected to live to see the day, is, and I started going down to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and, like, I'm from here. We don't have Confederate monuments, although my brother's in the front row. They're busy. He's on the committee to rename the Joseph LeConte School after somebody who wasn't a slave owner. And new name to be announced. That wasn't secret, was it, Steve? No. Okay, good. And my adorable nephews just ran off. And, you know, but they took down 4 Confederate monuments in New Orleans last year that looked like they would be there forever. And I was just there. And to see Lee Circle with this huge, like, pillar with no General Robert E. Lee on top was amazing. And the lynching monument just opened last week. And it feels like, you know, there's all over the country, and this is the kind of subtle incremental change that also really matters, of changing how we remember history and who we remember. You know, they took down a Confederate monument in Baltimore and put up a statue of Harriet Tubman, who's going to be on the $20 bill one of these days. And we're just really, you know, and that's part of one of these huge shifts that is kind of amazing, that's really about whose story is it, who gets to tell the story. And I see people, to wrap up, with a lot of critical tools to understand how these things work and who they work for, that I don't think people had to the same extent, you know, the ability to critique the dominant narrative, to understand whose voice isn't being heard, to ask different questions and to hear different people. And that's all that cultural shift is happening, and there's nothing the Republican Party can really do to stop it. They can screw up the textbooks, but they can't stop the grassroots storytelling. So that makes me hopeful.
Yeah, well, you capture so powerfully in Hope in the Dark the way in which, you know, it's the justification for activism. So many times you don't see the effects of your action right away. You know, you don't, the power to change stories isn't something that's going to happen, you know, the next day. It's not like, you know, changing a policy. It's a slower kind of change where you have to have a kind of faith in the worthiness of taking these actions. There's so many times when you commit yourself to a life of organizing that you're outpowered. By definition, our side is the side with less power. And yet, What I think you convey so well in Hope in the Dark is that all kinds of power don't work the same way, and there are kinds of power that are, you know, kind of catalytic or corrosive and can affect long-term transformations without armies or guns or generals or even electoral victories or court victories.
And that's part of what's so important that your book gets at, that the Clamshell Alliance did not shut down one nuclear power plant, but more than 100 nuclear projects were stopped as a result of the anti-nuclear organizing that they were catalytic for. And not only did the whole U.S., the nature of direct action organizing the U.S. change, but those tools are used all over the world. And, you know, and something else, as I look at my friend from 350.org in the crowd, is, for example, there was these really annoying guys who kept insisting, like, you know, like for years they kept saying, you're never going to stop the Keystone XL pipeline. And then it got stopped, and they're like, kind of, well, that doesn't stop all pipelines for whatever. But the way that change happens, and the process, the organizing on the Keystone XL pipeline made people aware, first of all, of the tar sands, of the pipelines, of the issues at stake. It became a great climate organizing tool. It actually woke people up to look at a lot of local pipelines that were stopped. And these indirect consequences, you know, it's not 1 + 1 = 2 if you get all the way there. It's these complex, interactive, I hate to use words like algorithms because Silicon Valley exists and is evil. And, you know, but these complex kind of weather patterns and, you know, maybe chaos theory is a better model. And, you know, and so many of these things do stuff that you don't, that isn't direct. I am another reason same-sex marriage came around, and this was an essay I was so happy to write, was feminism made marriage a symmetrical relationship between equals. And once it's a symmetrical relationship between equals, why can't any two equals share that relationship? Whereas, because I was thinking one day, like, why does the right keep saying that this is a threat to traditional marriage? It's because they want marriage to be hierarchical, in it, you know, in which the man is the boss and the woman is basically, well, the servant, slave, property, etc. And so even though, you know, Bob and Fred's marriage is not a direct threat to, you know, Harold and Tina's marriage, the equality in it. And so it's also interesting seeing how liberation is contagious in these ways, that the patterns spread, the templates spread, the tools spread. And so, you know, and so I think there's a good argument that feminism, you know, helped same-sex marriage, and that, you know, and that, which is not to say it's a one-way street, that there's been a lot of back and forth, and of course a lot of the best feminist work done in the 1970s in particular was lesbian separatists and people who are kind of like, you know, what are men for? We're so over that. nothing personal, men, but it was a really interesting part of feminism that's sort of not remembered, was the idea of, like, you know, maybe we just need to have a party that they're not invited to.
I know, really.
And then they did, and a lot of them. And I see Kate back there who remembers all that. But it's exciting that people seem to get these more sophisticated stories now, and that subtle change is one of the things that is such an important skill for being hopeful, for understanding change, for fomenting change. And, you know, and it's also interesting to me, the stuff that's so incremental, like in the era of Hurricane Katrina, people were still willing to believe these horrible stories that people turn into marauding barbarian hordes, which was used to turn New Orleans into a prison city after the hurricane and the flooding of 80% of the city, and used to justify the police shooting a lot of black people in the back, a story I became very involved in trying to bring more attention to afterwards and stuff like that. And even with the Haiti earthquake in 2010, the mass media was kind of telling those stories. I saw them with Hurricane Harvey and things, trying to tell those stories, and people saying, nope, we don't buy that, that's bullshit. we don't, you know, don't use the word looting. We're not going to tell those stories. We're not going to let you have those narratives where authoritarianism is justified by these social Darwinist Hobbesian, you know, untruths.
Yeah. To return to what you were saying about the influence of feminism in the fight for gay marriage and lesbian and gay rights more generally, and there's a strain of the pushback against the movements we've been discussing throughout this whole session, which is the attack on identity politics and the very tired trope that says that what has happened with the rise of identity politics has been a fragmentation of the left, and that what we have now is division, fragments, shards, and suggests that there's a kind of separateness to all these movements, which when you look at them is not true at all. What there is are new kinds of connections, new kinds of synergies, new kinds of networking. When you look very closely at the landscape of all of these movements, the influences from movement to movement are strong and powerful and pervasive. What there is a defiant autonomy at the grassroots, that people are very interested in elevating and sustaining their own voices and agendas and not being subsumed into some artificial unity. And that's very different. It's a very different vision than, you know, the kind of thing we hear from the likes of a Mark Lilla or so forth that suggests that all that has happened in the last 30 years has been a breakdown on the left.
There are those white men who don't love movements they're not leading. But it has actually, but to be serious about it, that and this whole attack on identity politics, which came from Bernie Sanders and was this idea that it's somehow antithetical to an economic analysis rather than race and gender and class and economic status. And all these things are so interfused that you can't talk about them separately. There was an attempt last year by, you know, these men who think they run the left to announce that abortion was not an economic issue, and it was and that it was sort of optional for the Democratic Party and the left. And a bunch of women got right up and schooled them that the ability to control your reproduction is fundamental to women's ability to have economic self-determination. If you can't control your body, you can't control anything. That it is a fundamental economic need and right that women have. And it does feel in a way that it's they who are trying to divide us by saying shut up about racism, shut up about gender, go, you know, now we're going to lecture you about class. Yeah. And, and there's also this obsession with the white working class, which felt like it was obscuring for me that a lot of the working class isn't white. And they matter, and it wasn't the white working class that voted for Trump, that actually the Trump voters were overall wealthier than the Clinton voters. It wasn't, you know, we keep hearing these stories, and we also keep getting told that these people, you know, that, and there is a population of kind of old white American Protestant people who used to run the country, who feel disenfranchised, but we're constantly told to pander to them in a way that doesn't address the fact that some of them are very angry, but that they're not actually the dominant majority who needs to be placated. And one of the things that actually made me really excited is that white Protestants are like 44% of this country now. They are in no way a majority. And it's nothing, you know, some of my best friends are white Protestants. Nothing against them. But I grew up all my life being told that like sort of Jews and Catholics and all non-white people and stuff like that were kind of like special interest groups, and white Protestants were the dominant culture. And that inevitably we're just going to regress to their needs, agenda, norms. And to be reminded that they're not even a numerical minority, and of course they're shrinking as we become an increasingly non-white country, was really encouraging. And white evangelicals are about 20% of the population and shrinking radically. I find these demographics really encouraging. But, you know, but it does feel like there is a, I don't know. And there's this part of the left you write about in the book, if it's the left. And I keep thinking, and this is one of those questions, if it came from the audience, it would be kind of like, where's the question? But I think it's clear that you know, if the left is supposed to be about human rights and equality, then what do we do with all these misogynists who seem to think they're in charge of the left and who are generally not real good on race either?
I mean, I think they're being left behind. I mean, I think the grassroots is just, you know, moving forward quickly with different models in terms of who's doing the work and who's building organizations that matter, new styles of political engagement that matter. And, you know, maybe this isn't statistics. I mean, it seems like the pushback is a lot in the realm of punditry and discourse and not so much in the actual work. I don't see that pushback happening in the organizing circles I move in, for sure. There's context. There's, of course, you know, big NGOs that are headed by men who come out of this more traditional conception of the left. And you see some of that, but I don't see it at the grassroots.
And that's kind of what's interesting to me, is that you have a disproportionate number of these guys who have sort of bully pulpits and columns and radio shows and things like that. So they're sort of making a lot more noise than, you know, than is appropriate for the number of people they represent, in a way. So they're kind of hyper overrepresented in the media and the public discourse. And but it's nice to be reminded that they're beautifully underrepresented in organizing. I don't know. I've never felt more uncertain about what's going to happen next. And that feels sort of both exhilarating and terrifying.
Yeah, it's, I mean, one never can predict the future. But at this moment, it really does feel like we could be, you know, careening to all-out fascism, or we could be redirecting in a much more positive, progressive direction after, you know, this horrible interlude. It feels very hard to say, but I think the money is on their side, the institutional power is on their side, but as you say, the demographic trends are certainly on our side, and you know, at the risk of being corny, I think the heart is on our side. That there's a deep sense of humanity that has motivated people to action over this last 15 months. A deep sense of humanity and solidarity. And you know, when I've been at these big protests that have happened, I'm just blown away. It was just really blown away by the heart that people are bringing into this work right now.
I kind of don't believe that, you know, they could kind of seize the government and suspend all democratic institutions, et cetera, because we're too big and chaotic and insubordinate a country. My greatest fear after the election is that it would feel like life after 9/11, that people would be deferential and they'd be able to frame that patriotism means, you know, self-censoring obedience. And you remember, like, how intimidated immigrants were. They're all flying American flags to prove that they weren't outsiders and stuff. And then you just saw that, like, one of the things that I find incredibly cheering, every time the president tweets, hundreds of Americans get on board to tell them how much they despise him and how wrong and bad and doomed he is. And they are absolutely fearless. And it's just that kind of, like, they're not intimidated, they're not fearful, you know, you're not going to terrify those people, you know, we're a really large country, and, you know, and I can't quite imagine how you would, I know there was the Soviet Union, but...
Right, well, my more realistic fear, I don't really think we're careening into outright fascism, but I am concerned that Trump could be reelected in 2020. I mean, that we could do very well in the midterm elections, and then people could go home and become complacent and neither do the very necessary work. Whoever we elect, however great they are, we need independent movements that are pushing them from the outside to achieve. This is, but we also need to not let down our guard. I mean, I don't think Trump was legitimately elected. I think the election was stolen, at least in slow motion, if not in real time, through voter suppression and gerrymandering. It was a clever trick they could pull off again. There is enough of a base. If you spent, you're not going to see it in Berkeley, California, but in a lot of other parts of the country. I was just in rural Pennsylvania in the area around Lancaster, and I spend a lot of time in a pro-Trump area of upstate New York. And there was a period after the election when people kind of took down their Trump signs. And they've gone back up again. You know, there is a rallying of the base. There is a galvanizing of the other side that I don't want to overstate. But my fear is that our side does well in 2018 and then becomes complacent.
Which has been kind of the cycle we've seen in my adult life has been we elect a Republican, everyone wakes up. We elect a Democrat, everyone takes an eight-year nap. And I worry about that cycle. But I guess something else I think about, and this and something that really struck me when I started spending time in the South is like, wow, the Civil War never ended and the Confederacy never went away. It's a term I use sometimes to describe this kind of new version of the right. But it feels, and there's a whole story about Reconstruction and et cetera behind that, but it feels like the short-term goal is to defeat them electorally, but the long-term goal has to be the cultural transformation so that people, that kind of racism, that kind of enthusiasm for authoritarianism, that kind of idea that the past was better and we should go back to it. And do you ever think about how we do that work? How do we, it's not how we win by opposing them, but how we win by absorbing them in some way? And I think their children will do it to some of them, but...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. What I think is the missing ingredient right now is what I was alluding to before, is that I think it's a real problem that we're not seeing, that people are resisting the damage of the Trump administration, but it's not happening. But we're not seeing tactics as strong as the rhetoric, let's say, of resistance. And The thing about that kind of work, it goes back to the things in my book about groups like the Clamshell Alliance, is that work of strong resistance of, honestly, why are more people not blocking ICE vans? Why is there not more of that? I mean, it's happened. When they tried to deport Ravi Ragbir, a community leader in New York City, people did go and block the van. And, lo and behold, the court extended his process. He has not yet been deported. He's gotten a reprieve. And we're kind of not seeing that kind of resistance that doesn't just resist specific harm, but it sends a cultural message and it sends a cultural signal that helps, I think, catalyze the kind of slower cultural change you're talking about.
It's interesting. I think people feel like, well, if there's a coup, and I've been thinking of just trying to figure out how to just announce, like, well, there was one actually, as a way. And that includes, I agree with you completely that the election was essentially stolen. The sort of all the exit polls in too many states didn't match the vote, and always towards Trump's benefit in ways that are statistically somewhere between highly improbable and impossible. And there's just things like that. But it's, and it feels like people, I think a lot of people are ready, but they're waiting for the signal and that Mueller's firing or something like that will be it for a lot of people. But it is one of the dangers of incrementalism, even though frogs actually jump out of the warming water, to be a scientist.
I didn't know that.
The frogs object to being characterized in that manner, which could bring us to rabbits, or it could just bring us to questions from the audience, because I know it's about time. So, and we would love to take questions from women of color first and not be too usual suspecty. And please no long Berkeley diatribes. Because I've lived here my whole life and like I already had them, thank you. I even had one last week at David Korn's event.
Hi, thank you so much for talking and coming here. My name is Casey, and I'm in transition, so I'm taking some just random De Anza College classes, and actually the professor that just started the social change program there about 7 years ago is Cynthia Kaufman. So I don't know if there's any relation to that, but anyways.
No, we're not related.
Okay. But I was wondering, can you speak a little bit more about, I guess, because I think all of the things with like the mass shooting and the male aggression and like all of that is a part of the, you know, toxic masculinity of culture. And it seems like there's a lot of things in play with that, including like the sense of entitlement. And when they don't get it, they just kind of, you know, like there's a lot of different aspects. So how can we, how can change happen with that? And I'm sure like our current leader is probably like the poster child for that. Toxic masculinity. Yeah, thanks.
You know, I think that a lot of men are, you know, living in a world where women are people endowed with certain inalienable rights and are equals and et cetera, but there is a lot, and a lot of this does feel regressive, and a lot of it seems to come out of the internet. And we've heard a lot in the last week about how these incel guys organize, you know, and kind of pursue their narrative of grievance against women and their, you know, violent fantasies. And of course, you know, the kind of misogynist, and the internet is such a destructive place, and I think in isolating people and promoting conspiracy theories. And it's a place, you know, internet porn has created a lot of misogynist kind of modeling of what it means to be a man and a woman for that kids grow up on and stuff. So I don't, you know, but one of the things that really struck me about this, and I was very involved in following the Isla Vista massacre 4 years ago next month, was not only the narrative of entitlement, which is pervasive, you know, because people keep trying to say, like, oh, there's this new incel phenomenon, and it's online, and it's very weird. And it's basically the dominant culture story. Women are objects that men acquire to gain status, you know, and, you know, women, and these objects can be punished and destroyed and disposed of and et cetera. But it's also a really sad narrative, because there's nothing in anything in those narratives about kind of passion, about desire in a way that has any kind of joy, tenderness, affection, even really pleasure in it. And it's such a dehumanized version for the men as well as the women of what it means, what sex is, and how we can connect to each other. And it feels like, in a way, addressing directly what's wrong with it is important. But I think also there's the work of discussing, you know, it's life without compassion, life without empathy, and you know, and promulgating this kind of other narrative of like, hey, this is what it's like when you're doing stuff with people with someone who really likes you and who's like there willingly, and you know, and stuff like. So it's, you know, so I don't know quite how to fix it. But I feel like something we haven't addressed very directly is, well, what's the alternative to that completely bleak and alienated narrative of sex is a thing women have that men have to get through hostile means, you know, or punish women because they're not getting it. And that's part of it. And I think we also need to not let these extremes be treated as isolated. They're concentrated versions of the dominant culture of misogyny, but they're not unique or so weird or mentally ill or something that they have nothing to do with it. And it's like the Playboy philosophy boiled down to a lump of stupidity. And,
I can't add to that. I can't add to that.
Yeah, other questions?
Hi. So I wanted... I'm over here.
Oh, yay.
I wanted to ask in regards to the Me Too movement, there's been a lot of, which is great, but there's been a lot of talk about how it's exclusionary to a lot of women of color, a lot of disabled women, a lot of trans women, a lot of sex workers. So I'm wondering if, because you guys talked a lot about how feminism has propelled us further socially, do you think you could talk about how the Me Too movement has left so many of us who aren't white, who aren't straight, out of, you know, being heard, and also how those of us who are on the sides are also doing the work? Because when Roy Moore was going to be elected, mostly white women voted for him. Even though his victims were white women, it was black women and men who voted for his opponent. So could you discuss how marginalized women are the ones doing the work, whereas the majority women are the ones who are being heard?
I mean, that, yes, absolutely. That, I mean, that dynamic has been true in a lot of contexts, not just in Me Too. And that's been, in some ways, I think, some of the most important kind of internal political struggle that's been happening within the resistance movements has been around intersectionality, around racial justice, around centering the voices of women of color and women who are from other marginalized categories. With, you know, with the Me Too work, it replicated what happened with the women's marches, where the women's marches started out with a couple of white women making Facebook posts, and there was a catch up. It happened, you know, much more quickly than it did, you know, with comparable movements a decade ago. Movements are really trying to grapple with this, but it took a real like shifting of course early on, and the same thing happened with Me Too, with the erasure of Tarana Burke's work in the original conversation. The resistance is overwhelmingly women. It's definitely been majority white women. And there's an opportunity there because of how white women provided a crucial margin of electoral victory for Trump. But if white women in the resistance are not going about their organizing with a true appreciation for racial justice and intersectionality, it's going to end. I mean, there are traditions of white women's organizing in the Ku Klux Klan and in the John Birch Society and in the groups that have actively defended racial segregation and white supremacy. So simply the fact that it's women in motion doesn't make it intrinsically progressive by any means.
And there's a, thank you. And there's a couple things I want to add to that, which is that the original Me Too was focused on Hollywood actresses who were super heteronormative, glamorous white ladies for the most part. They did, you know, and so there's ways in which it's fails, but there's ways in which it's done some really good things. The Time's Up Foundation, which I think the actresses raised a $25 million endowment for, is designed specifically to address sexual harassment of sort of low-income workers, and has been, you know, and so there's ways in which they're trying, and it doesn't mean that they got it right. And then, you know, there's the Oscars, I don't follow these awards, where they brought a lot of the women of color doing the actual work to the event and stuff. So there's ways, you know, and it's also about how we tell the history of feminism. One of the things that's really kind of like revolutionized my understanding is Daniel Maguire's The Dark End of the Street. I don't know how many of you know it, but it's a book arguing that Rosa Parks and black women in the South were engaged in a fight against white male sexual violence in the 1940s and 50s that got kind of overshadowed by the male-led civil rights movement and forgotten. And so I feel like there's a history of white feminism that left out women of color. There's also a history of feminism in which white women aren't necessarily centered, that I feel like we've lost a lot, you know. And there are landmarks like the, you know, Anita Hill's testimony that can be part of it. So I'm saying, like, so I want to kind of like hold both of those. There have been these moments that are awesome, and there have also been these moments of inadequacy and failure and things that need to be done much better. And it feels like at least now we have the criteria in place to look at something and say, like, this isn't, you know, these people aren't represented. This is not inclusive. This is not happening in ways that were treated, that were more invisible before. But I think it's been an important part of how you can try to address rights and kind of make or redress wrongs and make your own exclusions and not, you know, get partway there and fall short or create new problems in the process. You know. So, yeah.
Hi, I'm Anu. And, LA and Rebecca, can you speak to what you see as the potential in the current moment for organizing on an international level? Anti-capitalist work on, you know, agitating against neocolonialism, women's, you know, worldwide women's liberation, et cetera.
Oh, that would just be a question about almost everything everywhere. But and I was in South Korea last year where they have an incredible feminist movement going on, and I met somebody recently who's has a book coming out this fall about, it's called, I think, Resisting Big Brother, about feminism in China. And you know, in India and Turkey and all over the world, feminism is in this kind of resurgence or kind of like moving the story. It feels like it stalled out in a way for a few decades, and that maybe some slow incremental changes were made, but we weren't really reframing the situation or addressing the crisis of violence, which is what a lot of this has been centered on. So the capitalism, all I can say to that is that the triumphalist narrative that communism had failed and capitalism had succeeded after the 1989 end of the Soviet bloc feels like it subsided, and that a lot of people now recognize, I don't know, as David Graeber put it, that capitalism is one of the worst ways there is to do socialism. And
I have to say, I feel like there have been some steps backward in that regard. The era of the global justice movement and the big mobilizations around the trade summits was a moment when I feel like the sense of global connection between movements was very alive in the United States. We have, you know, long traditions of exceptionalism and isolationism in this country, and that was a moment when we were not only grappling with the rise of neoliberalism and the power of global capitalism and trying to coordinate across borders to challenge it, but where there was all kinds of cross-fertilization happening in terms of everything from tactics and styles to demands. I know very much the sense within the global justice movement here in the U.S. was that we were taking leadership from the global south and that we were following rather than leading. And I think the election of Trump has made us a little more isolationist again, or a little more inward looking, the great exception being the immigrant rights movement and the ways in which the immigrant rights movement has been bringing not just global connections, but new forms of organizing into our landscape of resistance, whether, the kinds of massive strikes that were started with the Day Without an Immigrant, and then, you know, picked up in the women's strikes that have happened, on a larger scale last year than this year, but are kind of interesting tactically and interesting approach. You know, all of that comes very much from the immigrant rights movement and the kind of organizing traditions that people brought with them when they came here. But I fear that that Trump and Trumpism has to some extent gotten us looking inward, and when, of course, we should be looking outward and connecting more.
Thank you. Although at the same time, I do feel like Trump is kind of running the car into the ground, that he may spell the end of the American empire through sheer incompetence and destruction. The U.S. is the U.S.'s status in the world has fallen dramatically, the willingness of people to trust and cooperate. And, you know, and there's, I'm not interested in isolationism, but I'm interested in not being an empire and getting rid of some of our 800 foreign military bases and stuff. And I just wonder if he's not out of any good intentions, but if he's going to kind of like just crash the car.
You're such an optimist.
No, I'm just hopeful. That's different.
Yes, hi. Ma'am.
Thank you guys for speaking. But so my name's Allison. I'm an aspiring journalist, and you guys talk about telling more sophisticated stories and reframing what successes can look like. So what role do you hope that the media and that public storytelling can have going forward as journalism continues to evolve and change, specifically kind of in this moment and how it pertains to social change and activism?
Nobody has tiny little questions. What's your favorite color? What was I going to say? And it's such an interesting moment in that I think it's a golden age for nonfiction writing and essayists and a lot of other voices. There's a lot of really exciting stuff happening with new news outlets like Slate and, I don't know, online, ProPublica and things like that. At the same time that, like, some of the, was it the Fresno Bee just laid off, another third of its staff or so, and the LA Times is in turmoil. And the financial basis for journalism and magazine publishing is in crisis, partly, speaking of the things that Silicon Valley brought us. And, which has led to a lot of things dominated by billionaires, which creates Jeff Bezos has been very hands-off for the Washington Post, which has been amazing and heroic in this age, and the New Yorker's doing spectacularly and stuff like that. But it does feel like having these really wealthy, having journalism be dependent on wealthy patrons is really dangerous. And there's things they're not interested in, aren't necessarily going to finance, starting with things that have, that they're not necessarily going to care about poor people. And there was a wonderful line my friend Jamie Henn at 350.org used when I asked him how he felt about the world after the Great Climate March in 2014. He said, "Everything's falling apart while everything's coming together." And I kind of feel that that's, and it's not exactly hopeful, but it's interesting. So I don't know, but I do also feel like we're doing better at understanding that we not only need to kind of report the story, but we need to understand what are the undercurrents of belief, the dominant culture stories or the alternatives to them that shape how we talk about this rape or this employment crisis or this pipeline or this war. And that work is happening in some interesting ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a paradoxical moment right now in terms of journalism, because on the one hand, there are more outlets and more opportunities for more voices to be heard than we've probably ever had, and it might be harder to make a living at it than it ever has been. There are more opportunities to write, but they pay horribly. It's very difficult for people. Back when I was coming up, I could pay my month's rent with one column for SF Weekly. That would pay my rent for an apartment in San Francisco's Mission District back when we first met in the 90s. Obviously first of all, the pay for a single column has gone down for what you could, if you can find an outlet that's going to pay you, month after month at all. So on the one hand, there's this incredible opportunity to tell new stories and to get new voices out there, but the economic basis for doing so, it's almost like they were connected. Like the minute that we have more women and people of color and diverse voices coming to the fore is when the model for supporting yourself, much less having a family wage, like a wage where you could support a family, has become almost impossible. The number of staff writing positions that are left in the United States of any kind is, it's shrinking constantly. So it's simultaneously crucial work that you're doing. And if you're feeling a sense of struggle around it, it's rooted in these structural changes that have taken place in the media business that have made it harder and harder to contribute your voice in a way that also enables you to sustain yourself.
We have time for one more question.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Kendall. Here's my Berkeley diatribe. My mom used to play in this very park. I'm Berkeley born and bred.
Where are you? I can't.
I'm right here.
Oh, okay.
So yes. I read an article in the Financial Times, and this is to follow up with your journalist question, that there is an actual plan to try to get Trump to win the Nobel Peace Prize for the North and South Korea thing. And I just can't believe, I'm so disappointed in the way we're using information in this country now. And I'm just wondering what you think if they pull this off, because they're trying to do something to make him God. And I'm very disappointed in it all. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I want to do a shout out for the Nobel Peace Prize winner in the audience, my sister Lynn Price, who's one of the climate scientists who won the Nobel Peace Prize. For
I think the good news is that the Scandinavians are not part of the cult of Trump, and you know, it is, he does have this weird cult-like status in this country with some people, and there's this weird kind of Jesus aura around him. I saw this like Trump store, I think in Las Vegas, that showed pictures of him like with a 12-pack, and you know, I'm talking about abs, and you know, and then this strange thing that's been circulating on the internet, a picture of him teaching a boy to fish who's put down his socialistic college textbooks, when it's kind of like, we all know Trump doesn't know how to fish anyway. But it's like, the Nobel Peace Prize people are not going to, you know, like they're going to laugh all the way to, I don't know, their lager. Schnapps? Should I say schnapps? Lutefisk? And maybe that's, I don't know. Any parting words, L.A.? It's so lovely to be hanging out with you here.
I know. This has really been a pleasure. You know, I think my parting words are really coming back to the theme of hope, which is that we are in a time of incredible mobilization unlike any we've ever seen before. And we, amid all the threats and the scariness of this time, I think we have to just hold strong with the momentum that we've built, the damage that we've managed to hold off so far, and the promise that we have of really laying the groundwork for some truly deep transformations. Not tomorrow, not next week, but over time.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.